From HowStuffWorks.com, this is The Stuff of Life.
Welcome to The Stuff of Life. I'm your host, Julie Douglas. In previous episodes, we've explored fear in its many forms. We've tinkered with the idea of immortality by making virtual stick figures to out-survive us. And we've looked at our complex relationship with objects and how they become stand-ins for our existence. You could say that we've been dancing around a certain topic, a topic central to life itself. What you might say is the flip side to the same coin, death.
Who is the third who walks always beside you? When I count, there are only you and I together, but when I look ahead up the white road, there is always another one walking beside you, gliding, wrapped in a brown mantle, hooded. I do not know whether a man or a woman, but who is that on the other side of you?
"Who is the third who walks always beside you?" is a line from T.S. Eliot's The Wasteland. It was inspired by Sir Ernest Shackleton's account of a 1916 expedition to Antarctica in which Shackleton's party was forced to abandon their ice-beached ship and march for 36 grueling hours over mountain ranges and glaciers. In Shackleton's tale of survival, he recalled that he felt a presence with him, that another had joined them. This became T.S. Eliot's The Third, for which the third man factor is named. It's a phenomenon experienced by people in dire circumstances, circumstances that clearly mark the line between life and death. The third person has been interpreted as a benevolent spirit, a guide, and even death himself. In this episode, we put out a pot of tea, a plate of cucumber sandwiches, and we take a seat with death. At the table is end-of-life guide Betsy Trapasso.
Sometimes I call myself like a death detective. I'd go in and kind of like a checklist. Okay, this person, is it this, is it this?
We talk with my How Stuff Works co-workers Christian Sager, Catherine Whitborn, and Lauren Vogelbaum about, well, the end.
The more that I learn about our bodily processes, the more I'm like, oh, we are so delicate. Mm-hmm. Oh, this is horrifying that we're just walking around all the time as though we're going to continue doing that, and we're not.
And we talked to Dr. Christopher W. Kerr of Hospice Buffalo, whose study on end-of-life dreams in terminal patients is changing our ideas about what it's like to die.
So intense, and it's so different than anything else. I don't know if it's relatable to us in the same way that other experiences are.
But first, what is it like to sit beside the dying, to be there for the sole purpose of ushering a person through the most critical phase of their life?
People always say dying is easy. And then I say, have you ever tried to die in the United States? I'm like, it's not so easy. You know, there's wills and probate and who gets the car and who gets the house and, you know, possessions to divide up and our families fighting over things. My name is Betsy Trapasso, and I am an end-of-life guide and advocate in Los Angeles, California.
Betsy has a background in psychotherapy and as a hospice social worker. So when she enters someone's life, she puts all expectations aside and meets the person where he or she is, guiding them through not just the day-to-day physical business of dying, but the metaphysical, holding a space for them to explore what it's like to face the ultimate unknown.
You know, with end of life, there's so many questions and so many things that people don't know and things that they don't know that they know. So part of my work is helping them come to some kind of experience of, okay, let me help you with the practical things so we can get those out of the way so then I can do kind of the holding space. The holding the space is really beautiful. And being there for the person and where they're at. And sometimes it's just being quiet. and letting them tell you what they're thinking. Or for the family who's overwhelmed, you just come in with this calm, holding space and letting them tell you what they need to tell you. And they will. And they're grateful that someone's finally listening.
Betsy has a TEDx talk, Death and the Desire for a Hollywood Ending. In it, she talks about the AIDS crisis before the 1996 development of the AZT cocktail, where Betsy had up to 5 clients a day dying from the brutal effects of HIV infection. It was during this time that a client named Rob asked Betsy for a Hollywood ending.
Yeah, in the movies, right? We see everything's always made, like, perfect.
You're gonna be all right, kid. I haven't got a complaint in the world, Rock. I'm not afraid.
Everyone's forgiven. They all talk, you know. And he gave me the idea of, okay, what can I do for everyone to give them as close to the ending that they would love and want? Like, how can I heal the relationships? How can I help them do that? How can I help them say goodbye who they need to say goodbye to? Like, what can I do? And it won't be perfect, but it will be as close to the desire, how they want their end of life to be. And in some people, it will never happen, and you just have to help them come to terms with that. Not everyone dies who's been a perfect person, or they might have hurt somebody or been an alcoholic or distanced people from them. And sometimes people don't want to forgive. And I always say death comes in always like all shapes, sizes, colors. You never know what it is. And some people do, they call it rage against the light. You know, they don't want to go.
And some prefer not to be witnessed at all.
Some people do want to die alone. You know, I mean, and that was also something that's interesting too. You know, they're like, I want to be alone. I don't want anybody to be with me when I die, which is very interesting because they would tell me that and they would make sure they died when no one was in the room.
The thing about dying is that it's not just cultural, it's generational.
I mean, when I started like 20 years ago, I was helping World War I veterans, World War II veterans, people from the Holocaust, Depression era people die. And, you know, a lot of the men and people were very practical. They didn't talk about, oh, I lived through the Depression or the Holocaust, and why should I talk about it? And the men were like, what? You know, therapy, feelings, put me in a nursing home, it's okay. Like, you know, they were like, wanted to do things that would make it easier on everyone else. We're becoming less afraid and we're becoming more open because the baby boomers are, you know, and I always said 20 years ago, I'm like, the baby boomers are not going to do death the same way that my patients were doing it. So it was something that was hidden in our culture, but I really see this change happening.
As part of her advocacy work, Betsy runs something called the Death Cafe. It started with John Underwood in the UK, where people would gather for a discussion.
So let's talk now to John Underwood, who is the founder of the Death Cafe franchise. John, thanks so much for being with us. Why did you come up with this idea of having a place for people to come and have tea and cake and talk about death?
Well, I just think that kind of thing should be available. I think talking about death is a very normal thing to do. I know most people don't want to, but for those of us that do want to do that, there should be a safe space in which to do so.
American hospice social worker Lizzie Miles hosted the first Death Cafe in Columbus, Ohio, and Betsy began hosting in L.A. in 2013.
I make mine like really small and 3 hours long, and people bring food. And like for the first half hour, we don't even talk about death. People just get to know each other. Like I don't even have them sit down and talk about death. Like they just, it's like that you're at a party because it makes it so much easier to kind of just, you know, ease into it. So I always say it's not a support group. It's not a therapy group. Some people just are curious about who else comes to a death cafe. You know, it's, you get all kinds of people. Some people have had people who have died or suffering through Alzheimer's.
At the heart of palliative care is improving the life for the patient and the family. And this includes improving dying. To this end, Betsy's seen an increase in awareness of palliative care programs. But still, she worries about the 78 million baby boomers and who will fund the end-of-life care that they need. And she encourages everyone to look into resources.
Look for death cafes, death salon, death over dinners, conversation projects. Like, if you need resources, there are things that are out there. I just want people to feel like they're not alone.
For Betsy, the ability to help someone depart the world less anxiety-ridden and more at peace is a gift she can give. And she does this by not just standing by and witnessing a person's life come to a close, but by opening the conversation about it. A conversation she wishes we would all engage in much earlier in our lives.
The reason why we're gathered today is because...
Dearly beloved.
Dearly beloved. Is because we are discussing aspects of death because of something called the Death Cafe.
I'm Christian Sager. I am one of the co-hosts of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, and I am a writer-host here in general. I write for video and for the site.
I'm Catherine Whitborn. I'm an editor.
I'm Lauren Vogelbaum. I am a writer, researcher, host, human for How Stuff Works.
You know, I had an experience where my father was actually shot in a holdup, and he died. And I remember before that, I mean, death was just something you could not talk about. And it was so traumatic, but in a way it almost like freed, you know, it was like I could talk about it, you know, and I think about that because sometimes people say, you know, if someone dies, they say, you know, I don't want to say anything because I don't want to make it worse. Actually, talking about it makes it better a lot of times. Just to bring the person into it, you know. And after that, in my mother's case, you know, after that, we started talking about I could talk about it with her. Like, and she said, you know, when I go, this is how I want my funeral to be. These are where all my things are. So everything was put in one space so that everything would be, you know, together and accessible. And these were things we could not have talked about before.
Mm. Yeah, and that probably seems like and feels like a lot more of a mature way of approaching it and was cathartic for you, I imagine.
Yeah, absolutely. It really was because as you talk about it, there's so much fear of the things we don't talk about are often the things we fear the most. And talking about it makes it more, you know, manageable. And you don't have to be afraid as much as you think you do.
I don't know how you guys feel about your own death, but I'm actually not very afraid of dying. I mean, you know, of course, like, you know, I try not to stand too close to the edge or anything like that. But the thought of other people dying is very upsetting to me. And I probably base way more of my like psychological room on that than anything else.
I would say that when I had my daughter is when I really began to feel that, like on a physical level, a kind of terror. Like, first when I had her and I was like, what have I done? I've created someone who's going to die. And it was heartbreaking because, you know, you love someone so much. And then again, when she was around 4, I think, when she really understood, like, oh, dying is real. And thinking, oh, no, now she knows. And it's just, again, like, that's when I felt it in my body, not just, you know, emotionally, like this is a terrible, sucky thing.
I think about in the past, like children's books, I mean, death was such a part of them. It was, you know, you read those stories from the last century because death was not just, it was in books because it was a part of life in those days. I mean,
way more than it is today, yeah.
Exactly. So people saw people died in their homes. You know, a mother might have several children and some of them died. And death was more a part of life, for want of a better word, than it is now. Now it's sort of separated. And so in a way, I think it's harder to deal with because you don't see it. You know, it's usually pushed aside.
Yeah, and we whisk it away to that medical industrial complex so that we kind of don't have to look at those ugly parts.
Right.
Well, so for me, like when you first asked us to come in here, the very first thing I thought of, I'm a horror writer outside of work. I write horror short stories and comic books. And so it's on my mind a lot. And one of the sort of like holy grails of horror literature is Stephen King's Danse Macabre, where he talks about horror literature and movies throughout history, sort of what works with them. And it's obviously, at the end of the day, it's about death, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's about kind of grappling with death and understanding it. Although his version of it is that horror in and of itself is sort of the ability to capture a childlike understanding of dying in fiction and transport like the reader to that. So like his version of it is, he has a character in one of his books say, death is when the monsters get you. And that's such a like, that's a child's understanding of death.
My mother died of cancer when I was 8. And as a child, you know, you don't have this concept of death in the world. I mean, you know, I'd lost like a goldfish, and like, and she was sick for a long time, so I kind of knew it was coming, but I didn't understand adults' reluctance to just be straightforward about it. And I was one of those, if you can imagine, an awkward, precocious, child-sized Lauren, more child-sized than I am today. That's exactly what I was. And so I was like, what? It was so frustrating for me that no one wanted to just talk about it. And but as an adult, I find it interesting that when one of my friends loses someone that's that close to them, I do the exact same thing. Like I dance around it and wind up feeling like a huge jerk because it's impossible. Like societal standards for it are so strict that even if it's like your best friend, you go up to them and you want to say you want to treat them like they're going through a normal day, but of course they're not. Mm-hmm. And it's just so hard to wrap your head around how to deal with their grief. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know, I find my own grief a lot easier to deal with. I'm like, oh, I'm just going to be over here and I'm going to be messed up for like a couple years and it's going to be cool. I'll keep going. But dealing with other people's grief is very interesting.
And, you know, to your point, I'm totally the opposite of you, Lauren. I mean, no, I just go right in there. I mean, if someone has died, I feel like I feel very comfortable to say I'm sorry. I feel comfortable to ask them, tell me about the person. Or if I know the person and I have a good memory I can share with them, I do it right there. And, you know, it's definitely, you know, everyone's different and everybody approaches it differently or wants something different. But I just feel like it's just easier to talk about it now. And I wish we all felt that we could do that.
I think that for me, it's been uncomfortable to address someone, losing someone else, because I felt like my words would be so hollow, you know, for something that had happened, and that I wouldn't be able to provide any measure of comfort. But a friend of mine recently lost her father, and I see that she needs to talk about him.
Absolutely.
And now I'm understanding better that this is very much part of her, not just grieving process, but trying to understand what happened. Because I think that so much of this is about us telling stories and trying to make sense of something. And so we can't help but to create those lines of logic over and over again and talk about the story of how someone died and why they died. Because it's helping to solidify some sort of order for us.
There's a finality to death, but when you begin to tease out the narrative surrounding it, you find a sense of motion, a journey, a passage, a conveyance of self to the void. And not just for the person who is doing the dying, but for the person who sits by their side and tries to make sense of it all.
Before she passed, she made the comment, he told me the end of the week. And I asked her and I said, Who's he? And she just pointed up to the ceiling. And she looked up at the ceiling. And I said, well, what do you mean the end of the week? And she just looked at me and she said, death. What do you say to that?
That's a son talking about his mother's end-of-life visions, about people visiting her, some of whom were deceased family and friends, many who told her the day that she would die. In the video by Palliative Care Institute Research, the son says he's okay with the visions and dreams, that they were helping her to get ready. These kind of end-of-life dreams, it turns out, are universal. And no surprise to hospice workers and caregivers whose clients regularly experience them.
In medical training, you're not even taught anything about dying. And what struck me was everybody but me seem to be able to prognosticate in some ways death approaching based on what people's experiences were and the content of them. And they also recognize the value therapeutically.
That's Dr. Christopher Kerr of Hospice Buffalo and the principal investigator in the 2014 study in the Journal of Palliative Care about end-of-life dreams and visions. In his TEDx talk, I See Dead People, Dreams and Visions of the Dying, Dr. Kerr says, quote, "We have all seen grim physical decline and suffering, and we've all felt profound loss. So if there's light within the darkness of dying, it's in the experience, not in the observing." And this is why he seeks to not just share, but quantify the words and experiences of the dying through his 2014 study.
For it to be palatable for the medical community, I knew it had to have some rigor to it. So I designed the first study not really to amuse myself, but to put metric to it, basically a currency that I knew that the medical community would be more likely to have to pay attention to. I monitor the drugs, check for mental status, all the things that is necessary to do. And it was also very important to do that to get away from the phenomenologic.
Meaning deathbed phenomena, the kind of stuff that's witnessed by caregivers or loved ones, but not necessarily scrutinized or quantified. One of the challenges of scrutinizing patients' experiences was making sure to distinguish the dreams and visions from delirium.
The biggest difference is I've never seen a delirious patient have a intact theme, content, or derive a meaning. These are the people that get tied up, you end up medicating. Horribly distressed. They'll stay awake for days out of fright. It's profoundly experiential. It's not insight into life. It's not replaying of past events in a way that gives you wisdom. That's not delirium. Delirium is seeing spiders, things coming out of the wall, somebody chasing you, horrible themes of attack and rape and paranoia. And in our second study, what we did was every time anybody had a reported a intact dream or vision, we also screened them for delirium.
I was laying in bed and people were walking very slowly by me. The right-hand side, I didn't know, but they were all very friendly and they touched my arm or my hand when they went by. But the other side were people that I knew. My mom and dad were there, my uncle. Everybody I knew that was dead was there. And they passed and did the same thing.
That's Hospice Buffalo patient Jeannie. Her dream content is about comfort and loved ones waiting, which turns out to be two of the six categories that the study uncovered as underlying themes. The others include preparing to go, watching or engaging with the dead, unfinished business, and distressing life experiences.
And even some of the distressed dreams that caused discomfort had meaning. For example, every single veteran goes back to war that we had in the study, every single one. And it seems that any threat to your own mortality during your life left a mark on you to which you return. And that included veterans who made it to basic training and not the theater of war. Sometimes these past traumatic events, they come back, they're certainly not pleasurable, but they might have meaning without causing discomfort. But the vast majority are comforting, the vast majority are visitation. And as you get closer to death, which was the surprise in the study, you get a disproportionate amount of seeing the dead versus the living. So that seeing the dead in greater percentages heralded impending death. But seeing the dead was also associated with the highest level of comfort.
It's a kind of built-in mechanism for transitioning the body and the mind. And in this way, Dr. Kerr says that dying is not done on a physical plane. And if you don't understand that, well, then you're trying to place the patient's experience in reality, and you're not able to recognize their journey and speak the same language, and you can't treat the patient in totality, the context of what their whole experience is.
I remember when my grandmother was dying, she had a
many nightmares, and she was working through a lot of stuff. So that made me curious, with caregivers, do they help patients to reframe their dreams, their more disturbing dreams, and do family members understand what's going on in these cases?
We've done a lot of work in that direction because it has a potential to be a barrier to the bedside for families and caregivers. And usually they're misinterpreted, I would say. And there's drugs involved, and or there, you know, there's metastasis to a brain or something. And if you demystify this, it's helpful. And that's what's so important about normalizing this phenomena.
Part of the reason why end-of-life dreams are underreported is that we just don't ask about them. And the other part is, well, there's a fear of ridicule.
I actually totally get it. I understand why they don't. Because it's not like you and I having a dream tonight about something that happened last week. Particularly the really intense ones, like war. It's very hard to look at people who, you know, in 2016 and tell them, look, I just spent 8 hours, back in Vietnam. And I saw everybody, and I'm telling you, I saw them. They could smell the smoke. I could, hear the gunfire. I was in a foxhole. I mean, it's so intense and it's so different than anything else. I don't know if it's relatable to us in the same way that other experiences are. It's not like saying I had a weird dream last night. And when they come out of it and they're not sure what's real or what's not, this idea that they're losing their mind, it's fearful, and often they're hiding and protecting themselves. I understand why it's a challenge for them. And it's all the more reason to ask. Because what we see is you can see physically people let go. It's to give them permission, that this is a very common thing you may experience and you'll be okay. And let's talk about it if you want to. And you can watch people physically relax.
And when people do feel like they have permission to dwell in their dreams and understand the therapeutic value, it can make all the difference.
My daughter makes silk scarves. She dyes them whatever people want, mixed colors, straight, and she paints on them if they want them painted on. And they were gorgeous. Great, great big beautiful colors and great big beautiful flowers. And we know outside during the month of July and August, we get these beautiful. I dreamt that I was at a funeral home and I was the only one there. And I opened the door, because I don't know why I was there. I don't know who was there that I would be visiting, but I went in and the whole room was filled with these beautiful flowers like Beth had painted on her silk scarves. They were just these gorgeous, gorgeous colors, these reds and yellows, greens and blues, like you find the flowers in the gardens, just these gorgeous, gorgeous colors. And they made me so happy. And I thought, isn't this beautiful? Such a beautiful scene. And I was so glad that had come into my consciousness.
I think that if you look and hear some of these folks, what they're describing, even in their final moment, they may have failing parts, but what they're experiencing in the deepest sense is very much alive. And to them, very real. And I think we should change our dialogue with them in a way that matches what matters to them. They're living and experiencing, and it's just in a very different way.
Thank you to Betsy Trapasso and Dr. Christopher Kerr for sharing your stories with us. You can find out more about their work in their TEDx talks. Thank you to Christian Sager, Catherine Whitborn, and Lauren Vogelbaum for sitting down and discussing death in such a personal way. In the next episode, Mourner for Hire, we'll take a look at how something as peculiar sounding as a professional mourner underscores the human need for ritual.
When we're looking at something like China or Taiwan, we have a rise of professional mourners that are for hire, often actors or Chinese opera performers that are have realized that this is a much more lucrative and easy way to support yourself.
The Stuff of Life is written and co-produced by me, Julie Douglas. Original music and sound design is by co-producer Noel Brown. Editorial oversight is provided by head of production, Jerry Rowland. If you like what we do here at The Stuff of Life, please consider supporting the show by reviewing us on iTunes. And you can email us at thestuffoflife@howstuffworks.com and find us on Facebook and Twitter.